Hi, you're listening to the Laser Blast Film Society, and on today's episode we'll be talking about the surprise deaths of a great character actor. A big question of, does an artist's life affect his work? We'll be tackling a French New Wave film and a classic comedy. And finally, we'll be going out with some recommendations and a little conversation about Wong Kar Wai. My name's Justin McClue, and I'm here today with...
Barry Starks.
And welcome to the new episode of the Laser Blast Film Society. So, I mentioned on the top there that there was a death recently of an actor that a lot of people love, Philip Seymour Hoffman. It actually happened just today. I think it was announced at about, like, 4 or 5 o'clock. That's when I read it on the internet.
Yeah, it's very, very recent. As of this recording, it's only been about, like, 5 hours since the news hit.
And when I heard about it, I was kind of like, oh, I hope it's not true. Like, yeah. I hope it's just a rumor.
Well, initially, because it's... it appears that the Wall Street Journal broke the story.
Oh.
So I thought that maybe they had been hacked or just been some of these... Because Philip Seymour Hoffman, because he is a character actor, he's one of those people that seems to get, you know, the internet hoax.
Yeah.
Hoaxes seem to attach. They seem to attract
Who
that
are
type.
People that are, like, usually hoaxed of dying? Like Jeff Goldblum, like, falls down, or, like, Jim Carrey? Or
it's kind of these actors where it's just, like, people know the name, but they're not, you know, it's not like a Brad Pitt or any of those type of characters.
Where that stuff can just be, like, put away very quickly.
Yeah, so I honestly thought it was just a hoax. As soon as I saw it, I was just like, you know what, this is just a hoax. Like, they got hacked or whatever. But then other news outlets started reporting it. Then it started to show up on ABC. And then, like, all these other... Then, like, CBC finally confirmed it. Just like, yeah, it happened.
Usually when people die, like, it's very rare in the last few times. Like, they'll be, like, you know, their run is done. Like, someone will die and they haven't acted for a while and that's sad. But when someone like Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's still... Like, he was just coming into his prime. Like, he was in The Master last year.
Only 46.
And he wasn't known as someone who would have that many, like, main roles. He was mostly, like a character actor. Like, he would take those little roles and make them memorable and, like, steal the movie from people. In something like Along Came Polly, which was the clip I had to post when it was announced. Not to, like, disregard him, but just to show how good he could be in even the shittiest film. Where he has that speech about sharding.
Well, I don't even think it's necessarily even a shitty film, but just like...
What, Along Came Polly? Well, yeah, it's a shitty film.
Well, no, I didn't mean that. I just meant in terms of, like, he could be in a movie for, you know, less than 5 minutes, but still you would just think of him like that when you think of the movie. He would just steal every single scene and second that he's in, because he's not in The Big Lebowski that much either, but people still remember his scenes in that movie.
And his laugh.
Yeah.
That's a YouTube clip that was going around.
Yeah, so it just goes to show, you know... How as an actor, he could take a film that he wasn't the lead, he wasn't the star of, but when you think of that movie, you think back to his role, you think back to his performance, you think back to, him, you know, portraying that character.
Any, like, Paul Thomas Anderson movie, which Philip Seymour Hoffman, like, Boogie Nights, Magnolia, specifically Punch Drunk Love and the big speech that he has in that, like, that is probably what is going to be his legacy as far as movies go, and, like, memorable parts will be those films.
Well, he also did have... I haven't seen it yet, but he... Like, didn't he win the Oscar for True Blood? Or in the Truman Capote movie?
Oh, he did win an Oscar. Best Picture. He did. Not Best Actor for Truman Capote. I completely forgot about that.
Yeah, so he's... Like, he's had a little bit of, like, leading man success. But the fact that it's... Like, you mentioned...
In character... character actor roles.
Yeah, but like he had The Master not too long ago, and just like I was really hoping that we would get more roles like that, where it's just like, you know, where he is the main guy, because as much as he can steal the show and just being in the film for 5 minutes, he can steal it even more by being in it for its entire running time.
Well, because he's like and I saw someone else say this, is that he's a very like nakedly emotional actor.
Mm-hmm.
Is that when he acts, like the viewer really feels it, and he has that ability, or he had that ability. I have to use the past tense now.
Regardless of his character, he always had a certain fragility about it, where you could kind of see through it, where it was just like, even if he was playing, you know, kind of a bastard character, there was still something that was kind of like tender about
the guy that have you seen Happiness, and he plays the guy that like calls people up on the phone and masturbates, or he's like, oh, you're dirty. I actually posted a clip, the trailer from Her, where they replaced his voice
with
they replaced Scarlett Johansson's voice with his voice in Her, and that you know, that's kind of sad that it had to come you know, his death had to come so soon after. And we were talking about, like, roles that we had seen in him, and I actually watched him in State in Maine, a David Mamet movie about making a movie in a small town. And Philip Seymour Hoffman played the screenwriter in that film who had to juggle, like, he wasn't really the main character because it was, like, an ensemble with, like, Alec Baldwin and William H. Macy. Mm-hmm. But he was definitely, he had, like, a... It was more calmer role where he wasn't like the crazy person or the character or the scene stealer, and he played like the straight man in the film. So it's interesting to see him in those kind of pictures also.
Yeah, as we've discussed his more character centric performances, he still does a great job as a straight man. Like, one of my favorite roles is actually his performance in Almost Famous.
Yeah, oh, he's so good in Almost Famous.
He's so good, but he's not doing anything crazy. He doesn't like have any insane scenes.
He is the scene stealer in that movie that people remember him.
But that's the thing, he's able to do it without having these, like, with Punch Drunk Love, it's easy for him to steal the scene because his character has, you know, these crazy moments. The same with Boogie Nights, where it's just like, it's such a, it's, the character is so far out there and he's able to make it so interesting. But once again, it makes it that much more of a feat and accomplishment that he's able to take these characters that seem kind of normal on the paper, mm-hmm. but still bring such a life and energy mm-hmm. to them that you'll remember them, even though, like, you know, you just read a synopsis, you're like, who's that character? What's that character playing to the role? But just the life that I was able to bring into it is something that I will dearly miss.
Do you plan on going and tackling some Philip Seymour Hoffman films now?
Yeah, a film that's been on my list for a while is I'm always
Synecdoche,
afraid.
New
I'm always
York.
Afraid that I'm going to bastardize.
Everyone says it wrong. That's the point.
But yeah, that's a film that I really want to see, especially now.
I think I'll probably see. I definitely want to watch that one again, which is one of my brother's favorite films. And I'm nervous to talk to him about how, because he was a huge Philip Seymour Hoffman fan, and Punch Drunk Love, and definitely Almost Famous. Like, I don't really need a reason to watch Almost Famous.
Yeah.
But Philip Seymour Hoffman in that film as Lester Bangs is very memorable. And, you know, this kind of segues into our next segment because I don't know if it's been confirmed yet, but he died from, like, a drug overdose. And like arm.
Those are the initial reports that are popping out, and it's not too much of a stretch considering that he did go on record not too long ago
saying that he had a drug problem.
He had a problem. It was something that he kind of thought that he kicked when mm-hmm. he originally got into the motion picture business, but it's something that has come back within like the past year or so. And
that he supposedly went and got help for it.
Yeah,
and
it just.
I guess it didn't work out for him, which brings up our big question of the week. I actually pitched this right when we started recording these Laser Blast podcasts anew, which was, does an artist's life affect the way that you perceive his work? And this question, like a lot of our big questions, is very generalized. Like, we can focus on specific instances that we want to, and it's never going to be something that we can say, like, this is the answer, and
we're not historic scholars on the events. We don't pretend to have the definitive answers. Basically, we just want to initiate a conversation, mm-hmm. that we find interesting, and we hope that, you know, the people that are interested in film and interested in the medium also find a conversation worth having, so mm-hmm. to speak.
So I'm going to have to pitch, you know, the question to you, because I am the one that's asking in this particular situation, mm-hmm. so I have the advantage of getting your answer before I can jump in and just comment on it. And, you know, you can talk about it a little bit, and then we'll talk about more specific examples of people that, you know, their specific career. And we have a specific person that ironically came up after I said we were going to talk about this, and he's been making the waves a lot lately.
Yeah.
But, like, does it affect you?
It does. It does. When you initially pitched me this conversation, you were just like, well, who are the filmmakers that you don't want to know about? And I'm kind of like, everyone.
Yeah.
Because out of my past, like, all these filmmakers that I eventually do learn more mm-hmm. about, I kind of wish I hadn't.
Yeah.
It's, I'm forgetting the phrase that it has, but it's kind of just like, you know, to a lesser extent, it's just like the more you know about your idols, it kind of it crushes them to some extent.
Yeah, well, because as, like, you know, human beings and as people that, like, take in art and people that we idolize, we like to put them on a pedestal. And anything that, like, lowers them on that pedestal, like, it affects the way you perceive them. Like, we're not going to name any names, but, like, just working with people that work in film, we learn a lot of stuff that really deflates us when we hear about, like, their experience. And we're like, oh, so they're not like that? Oh, okay. And, you know, it's the artist still there, but it's, like, different now. Like, you think of the person differently. Duncan Bruce, a friend of mine, likes to call me, like, the idol killer where he'll talk about an actor he really likes. Like, he'll be like, hey, did you know that Thomas Jane was like an alcoholic and was stopped like 10 times for drunk driving? And Duncan's like, oh, really? Why did you have to tell me that? So have you run into situations where you've learned something about someone and you've been like, oh, no.
On many occasions.
Okay, you got to give us some examples.
Oh,
the... let's not name names of people that like we're connected to. Yeah. Speak more like generally.
Yeah, no. Okay.
Stephen Kostansky.
No. We're
friends
Steve.
With that guy.
We love Steve. No, there's just many. I'm trying to go from more just general ones before
we get to
personalized ones. But no, it's there have been. You know, filmmakers that we do, you learn something about them. It kind of ruins the illusion a bit. The book Easy Rider, Raging Bulls.
Oh, that's a great example. Yeah. That is like just like, hey, look at all these people that are like mythological in the filmmaking scene. Yeah, they're all jerks and assholes. Yeah, like that's basically what it is.
It's just like the stuff that I heard about Spielberg and that like it just kind of ruined the illusion for me.
For Spielberg? I would say he's the one who probably gets it the easiest in reading.
I know, but that's kind of just like how brutal it is. Because the thing is that it's easy enough for us to look at a film or a piece of art and be like, yeah, that's an amazing movie. But because of that, we put it into this otherworldly, you know, category of just like, this exists on its own. It's a beautiful thing. Yeah. It's like a pure thing.
Yeah.
What we forget is that inherently flawed individuals are all responsible for making these, you know, things that we consider to be pure, like pure cinema.
I don't even remember Spielberg getting that. From what I remember in Easy Riding, Raging Bull, that Spielberg is just like a child, like stuck in this world, and he doesn't understand. I remember reading an anecdote about Spielberg where, like, at one point he took his whole crew on like a location scout and he's like, all right, let's go get some dinner. And then he went to McDonald's. And it wasn't because he's cheap, it's just that what he assumed people would want to eat.
Well, it's like I don't mean it's like it didn't really make Spielberg out to be a completely negative person. Yeah. It was more just it's just like as I started learning things about him that I disliked, it was more it's just kind of like I don't really want to know what's inside like this magic box that.
But
just
when
pumps
does it like
movies?
Accentuate someone's work and like other than them having obstacles to like you know Martin Scorsese in that book is just a giant asshole and like a coke doing like crazy man.
Well, the reason why I'm being kind of vague is because I started reading this book and then I stopped. Because I had to put it down because it's just like I. Because right now I'm going through this period where I'm trying to, you know, catch up on all these, you know, classic influential films that I've missed over the past years. And by doing that and by learning more, you know, what goes on behind the curtain, I'm just like, I did not want that to affect my viewing. I'd rather see all these films and be familiar with them and then made up my own
so
mind
if I was
and opinion.
Like Billy Wilder threw the switch in the gas chambers during World War II. Would that affect your viewing of Some Like It Hot?
Yeah, just a bit. But you just brought up Billy Wilder, but it goes back to, like, this is not something that's affecting us now. This has been around for a long time. Just like Hitchcock. Hitchcock is an individual where I do have to look at his films slightly differently after, like, all the, you know, the news about Tippi Hedren and all stuff came out. It's...
But, like, none of that is new. And, like, you can go back to artists before movies exist where, like, you know, Michelangelo liked to rape little boys. And look at his art. That's not true. I don't know. I just made something up. I'm sorry, the Michelangelo estate. This is not a fact-based comment. And, you know, like we were talking, because this is a big question. It's something that people have to discuss. And, you know, there's some people that I can name off the top of my head that the person making the movie, the more they learn about it, they... automatically disassociate. And to use a perfect example is Roman Polanski.
Yeah, Polanski is, he's kind of one of the big two out in terms of filmmakers. Yeah. That it creates a very decisive crowd where you basically have one side that's just like, you want his films are still amazing, they're still fantastic, but you have the other side where it's just like that guy's a bastard, like,
screw
him.
And because of that, you cannot enjoy his movies, period.
Yeah. It's, I was reading a little bit about the Polanski case earlier today. It's, out of all these things, like, it is, on paper, it's pretty screwed up, and all these things, like,
and like,
because it's so personal to these individuals' lives, it's hard to completely just be like, you know, this is exactly what happened, like, these are the pure facts, like, all that stuff. I'm not trying to defend Polanski in any sort of way, like what happened was pretty screwed. Like it's never that cool for someone, you know, his age to sleep with a 13-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. Like it's,
and at the same time, we also have to consider that no art is created in a vacuum. Like yeah. The artist is never like a blank slate that just like this art is, you know, spit out of him. It, what he makes or she makes is always affected by what has happened to them. And I think that the person that, you know, who they are versus the art that is created, like that is all interlocked. And I think that if you want sometimes to, you know, study a film and analyze it, you are forced to study the person. And it's impossible to, like, separate both of them. Even though many film theorists would say, like, no, you don't have to do that. You could just, the art is a sealed-off vacuum. And you just study what exists and not what comes out of
it. The art may be a sealed-off vacuum, but at the same time, that, you know, the people that are responsible for it are still instilling a part of themselves mm-hmm. into that vacuum. So it's basically just, like, taking all these pieces from you and putting them in this box. Like, it may not be attached to you anymore, but that person is still in there.
Yeah.
Those pieces are still very much present and still very powerful. So I think that's that is kind of the reason why it's so hard for people to detach, you know, the art from mm-hmm. the maker. And like, and of course, not just in films, but also in music especially. Like you hear about these things that pop artists and rock stars
do. Yeah, they're all the horrible things.
Yeah, like of course, the biggest example being like Michael Jackson. Like after like the allegations came out, like was it still kind of the same to go back and listen to like Smooth Criminal or Beat?
He's so bad.
Yeah, it's.
But his music has not, like, no one is like, Michael Jackson's music is bad now. Like, it's still there in the popular consciousness.
It was, though, when those allegations came out. People were just like, I don't want to, like,
really?
Listen to Michael Jackson anymore. It was something that popped up, and it was very, very prevalent.
Does it sound like that personal stuff just fades away after a certain point? It's lost in the streams of time? Because that's what it sounds like. And the music or the movies live on as pieces of art.
It depends on how strong the controversy is. Mm-hmm. Like, there have been so many, because Hollywood is not exactly the cleanest, most pure place.
John Ritter, the axe murderer.
Yeah.
That's not true either.
Oh, you had to bring poor John Ritter.
He's dead too. Whoops. Everyone loved John Ritter. That's a famous fact. So.
Yeah, but no, it's just like, something that I did not even know today. Like, Rob Lowe had a videotape sex scandal where
he did
in like 1989 or like 1990 where he was caught on tape having sex with a 16-year-old girl, and he had no idea that she was like underage, and they were just kind of like, it just faded, like, because you did not know that. The look on your face is rather priceless.
Which brings up the Richard Gere hamster up the butt allegation. Have you ever heard that before?
No.
You've never heard that before?
No.
That was like huge back in the day, that like Richard Gere liked putting hamsters up his butt, and it made like the tabloids and everything. And I say back then because I wasn't alive, but like listening to or reading news from that point, it was a big joke. And that's where the opening intro from Mallrats came from, where like is it Jason Lee? Geez, I don't even remember who stars in Mallrats. He's telling the story about how his uncle used to put like hamsters up his butt. So there you go. Like, we don't know, like, these allegations, as long as they're not, I guess, like Roman Polanski level, they do fade away.
Well, the thing is that there are certain things where, you know, if someone you knew did some of these things, you would never kind of forget it or let it go. But the problem is that Hollywood is such a place, you know, where it's...
You're moving too quickly.
It's legendary for its kind of, you know, its live fast and loose kind of morals.
Humphrey Bogart was an asshole. Like, that's public knowledge.
Yeah, so when it comes to that, people are kind of more... I guess I have to say forgiving when it comes to kind of these lesser sins, so to speak.
Yeah.
But, you know, people that we still find legendary, like Chaplin had his huge bundles of corruption, and people don't really talk about that now. They still just, it's always just like, oh, Chaplin, you know, it's classic. It's
Fatty Arbuckle didn't get over it.
Yeah, that's kind of
I hope there's like
case.
A 15-year-old who's like, who the fuck is Fatty Arbuckle? Which I don't know all the information, but he was a legendary comedian who supposedly killed a young girl.
Yeah.
And he was exonerated, and it still like drove him to depression and finally death.
Yeah, and it's like mentioned before with Chaplin, like the William Hurst scandal.
Oh yeah, which is the subject of Peter Bogdanovich's Cat's Meow. Yeah, about the deaths on William Hearst's boat.
Yeah, so there's always been these huge sort of
Nothing new.
Yeah, it's something that's always been, like you said before, it's always been present in art and kind of culture. But the problem is that when you get certain allegations that are just kind of too kind of messy to dismiss as easily, just like, oh, they're just Hollywood types. It's just like they have their own problems. They do whatever they do. It's just like it happens.
But something interesting that I don't know if this will be a point of every big question we have is that in today's culture where news is so like big, but then you have to push it away for something else, like, will this matter even less?
To be honest, I have to say I think it will, because of the fact that there have been all these things that have popped up because...
Well, you know, I mean, we have a mayor who smokes crack.
Yeah. But, thanks for reminding me. But no, I was just about to say, you know, like, we... In this information age, of course, like... I know I feel like such an asshole using that term.
Information superhighway.
But no, when you do have basically 24-hour coverage of celebs and gossip... I mean, there is so much to filter through. There's every single day something is coming out about, like, someone sleeping with this person, like, scandal, corruption, this and that. So it feels like none of it is really sticking. Like, it's just popping out. Like, if you're into that type of stuff, you will track it down and you will, like, learn about it. But,
like, basically murder and pedophilia are the only ones that were probably, like, pop on a national scale.
Those kind of stick. And I think that's... where the two biggest cases in this are Roman Polanski and Woody Allen.
Yeah.
And because of the acts that are allegedly or did happen with those directors, they are the two most decisive ones where you can still get into arguments with people about defending their work or liking the work that they made before these incidents even happen. It becomes very, you know, decisive amongst the crowds of supporters and detractors.
And... Roman Polanski is a guy who you could almost argue that he's, you know, he's been a Hollywood filmmaker, but in the last few years, he's just kind of faded away as far as being like a cultural force. Like, I mean, he made The Ghost Rider, which starred Ewan McGregor and
Carnage.
And Carnage. But those weren't big films. Like, they weren't on the cultural landscape in a sense of like public consciousness. While Woody Allen is a filmmaker that is consistently on the...
Well, with Woody Allen, it's kind of weird because for a while he did kind of dip into more, he was a little bit obscure for a while.
Probably in the 2000s, until 2006.
In that period, because he was still coming out with films, you know, all the time. But the fact is,
Hollywood Ending.
none of them were hits. It was just like, oh, it's another Woody Allen film. Here's another Woody Allen film. Mm-hmm. I don't think it really was until kind of Midnight in Paris, where it kind of brought back a revitalization, re-interest in the film.
You could argue that Match Point is the film that people were like, oh, wait, Woody Allen can still make good movies. Yeah. But Midnight in Paris is the one that, like, on the cultural, like, consciousness.
Midnight in Paris wasn't even just, like, reminding people that Woody Allen still exists. For some people, it was just, like, telling them that Woody Allen was a filmmaker for a lot of kind of new generations.
He needed Owen Wilson. You know, he tried Jason Biggs, didn't work out. But Owen Wilson was the one that could pull the crowds in.
Yeah. Jason Biggs, what happened to you?
Hey, he's on Orange is the New Black and he's doing very well for himself. But anyway, Woody Allen. We bring him up because in the last week, because Woody Allen won that CC B. DeMille Award.
At the Golden Globes.
It started like a Twitter. This is funny, like we're talking about the information age, is that like anyone can have their opinion or out there instantly that anyone else can read because, I don't remember his name, but supposedly Woody Allen, Mia Farrow's son, what's his name? Something Farrow.
Yeah, I don't remember his
name. Made a very disparaging remark against Woody Allen right after he won that award. And that started kind of like a chain reaction as far as people starting to discuss it again. And I heard that Woody Allen like didn't even know what was going on because Woody Allen is not, you know, a very technological guy. He writes on...
He writes on an old typewriter.
He doesn't know what Twitter is. Like, he kind of has an idea what blogging is.
Like he doesn't have the internet. He just keeps himself kind of, you know, separated from that from that world.
So do you think it affects him personally or do you think that he's just like... above or below that. You can interpret that in whichever way you want, or that he's been dealing it for so long that he's like...
Well, this is not a new scandal. This is a scandal that's been around for, like, what, nearly 20 years now?
And it's something that is consistently... We're not going to go into the Woody Allen scandal. Yeah. Like, that's not what we're going to call
this. We're not going to go into it completely. But, like, this is something that's not new. So I think, in his mind, he's already kind of dealt with it and set it aside. But the fact is that because of that achievement, it basically, you know, it stirred up the hornet's nest again.
But it also, it's because he married the woman... that, like, started pretty much that whole scandal, which was not his adopted daughter, but the adopted daughter of the woman he was seeing at the time, Mia Farrow, and he's still married to her. So that's, like, a constant reminder for people is that whenever he gets mentioned, she gets mentioned too, which leads into, like, this whole...
Well, even people who aren't even aware of the kind of the child molestation scandal that was brought up in court all those years ago, the big thing that people are still kind of just like, it turns them off of Woody Allen is the fact of the relationship that he had with his girlfriend's adopted daughter.
Yeah.
And me personally, like, it's something where when I watch a Woody Allen movie, that's still kind of in the back of my mind. And I'm going to be honest, it makes me feel like a little bit uneasy about the work that I'm viewing.
What about, have you seen Manhattan?
No,
because that movie is about him dating a much younger woman that's in high school.
Yeah, you see, especially watching that now, like, I don't know how I would react to it. Mm-hmm. Like, I still like Annie Hall. And like I did also really enjoy Midnight in Paris.
Yeah,
but those things are still in the back of my mind, even without like all these allegations that have been brought up again recently.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I still have to say that just the fact that, you know, this guy married his girlfriend's, you know, adopted daughter,
yeah,
still has an impact on me in terms of his work. Like, it still mm-hmm. affects the work in me in some way, because you know, films that I could easily just watch and just like fully absorb me, like, yeah, that was a damn great movie. I do have that slight reservation going, just like, does this work outweigh kind of the sins of the author, so to speak?
So your position is pretty much you'd rather know as little as possible so you can just enjoy the film and interpret it as just a film.
Yeah, well, this is something that's also affected me personally.
Yeah.
Justin, I've had experiences where it's just like...
I thought you were going to say, like, where Woody Allen has, like, got
involved. No, not with Woody Allen. And before we move on, do you just want to kind of close the Woody Allen thing? Because this is very kind of sticky.
We're not here to, like, make judgments or be like, I looked into the facts. That's not what we're talking about here.
No, it is
It is what it is.
It is also very serious allegations, which should be, you know, treated as such. It's not something to be like, when you're dealing with this situation, it's very complicated for both parties involved. You can't just be like, no, this one side is completely right and this other side is completely
right or wrong.
You can't,
because neither me, you, or like the million people on the internet have all the facts or know that kind of things. We're not detectives. Like, we can't go and interview these people.
It's screwed up. It's tragic. It's something that you don't ever want to have happen
anyone.
Yeah, to anyone. So it's just...
Yeah,
you know, hope it gets resolved, and, you know, justice to due parties is dealt with.
But speaking of justice, you were about to go and talk about personal things.
Yes,
but speaking in vague without mentioning any names.
Yes, I will not mention any.
Just
names.
Replace whoever this person to be. Could be Steven Spielberg. Could be Francis Ford Coppola.
Yes,
because Francis Ford Coppola is also a guy that Easy Rider, Raging Bull, cheating on his wife all the time, sleeping with women left and right. Like, no one wants to, like, come on.
Yeah, this is another reason why I was kind of just like, oh, why are you want to discuss this? Because you know this is something that has affected me personally.
I honestly wasn't even thinking about that. So it does affect you personally, and you can't, like, watch these filmmakers' films the same way anymore? Or?
Well, there is a filmmaker whose work that I do quite enjoy that has had some interaction with, you know, people that have been close to me in my personal life.
Mm-hmm.
And that does create a big difference. You know, this is something to you know, discuss completely theoretical in terms of just, like, you know, what they do in their private life. But what happens when, you know, someone's whose work you do enjoy their private life crosses into your private
life. So they're like, hey, Pierce, you want to hang out? You're like, oh, I hate this person. Why does he always want to hang out?
No, 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 not like that.
I understand what you mean.
But it people creates...
listening are like, what is he talking about? Like,
if you want the insider deets,
yeah, contact Pierce Dirks at 1-877 Pierce Line. But you can still approach that filmmaker's work.
I can, but it's a very, very different experience now. It's it does change things, and it's. And because it's bad enough, you know, to kind of know more about someone mm-hmm. and in their kind of unsavory
aspects
and have that affect the work that you watch on its own, because it's, you know, it's bad enough to watch a movie and be like, oh yeah, this actor's a complete asshole.
Yeah.
It does kind of take you out of the experience.
Alec Baldwin.
But you're always dissing on that.
No, I like Alec Baldwin, but I don't think anyone's going to deny that he's a bit of an asshole.
Yeah, it's true, but that's the thing. It's just that it's a problem with celebrities in general is that, you know, people that you would just, you know, day-to-day life you would gossip about to begin with. It's just like, oh yeah, whoever, you know, like so-and-so's buddy is doing their shit again. It would just be normal conversation. But when a lot of, you know, aspects of your personal life are broadcast to the public, it just kind of, if you're a good person, it makes you seem that much more awesome.
Yeah.
But if you're an asshole, it makes you seem that much
more. So, like, for me and you, if people, like, broadcast everything we would do.
Yeah, we wouldn't seem like good people. We would seem like assholes. Giant assholes.
Then that's the problem when you hear about, like you were talking about on a personal level, and that while I've been in Toronto, we get to hear about all these filmmakers and stuff like that. And the problem is like, everyone is human. And it does, you're like, oh. Oh, I don't want to know that.
Yeah, it kind of deflates you a little bit to kind of just, because like I said, you do put that work on another, you know, on another level. You do put it on a pedestal, and you're just like, oh, this work is so good. Like this is, you know, this is so much of what I aspire to be. But then to have, you know, the shine kind of like stripped away from it and chisel at and reveal that what's underneath is just, you know, kind of ugly at times and human.
Yeah.
And it does take something away from that, but at the same time, in some regards, it can make the work that much more interesting.
Or inspiring.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
But I, like I said, I don't want to get into the details of, like, my personal situation with
Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, with Spielberg. Yeah, yeah. We'll call him Spielberg. But it is something very interesting to think about, you know, an artist that you enjoy, what happens when their private life does intersect with your private life? Is it that easy to put aside, just like, oh, you know what, they're just a person as well, when it has direct, you know, consequences and actions with you?
Yeah. Spielbergian.
Yeah. But anyway, something that, when you did bring this topic, something else that I wanted to inject into the conversation. Have there been actors or directors or filmmakers or artists that you like more after knowing more about them?
Tons. I'm actually someone that when I like something or a movie, I do seek out that biographical information on directors and writers and actors, because I think that interests me and that informs what they do. And whether it's negative or positive, most often time it's negative, because it's easier to write negative things about someone. It's inherently more interesting.
It's the same as like negative reviews, or it's much easier to kind of hate something than it is to love it.
But at the same time, watching someone struggle to make something does make it more interesting. Like, I don't think there's any book that's more inspiring than reading Robert Rodriguez, Rebel Without a Cause diary, even though it sounds like making a hit film took him like 10 days or something like that, and it was super easy. But, that kind of stuff makes it interesting, even though Robert Rodriguez as a filmmaker is not very interesting right now.
Yeah, and also he's had a lot of scandal in his personal life as well.
What was the name of the girl that he started dating?
Rose McGowan?
Rosa McGowan, And I think they've broken up now. I don't know, because this is the thing that I said, that I actively look out this stuff, but I don't look for gossip. Like, I'm not someone who visits TMZ or, I don't know,
or like Perez Hilton.
That's not something that interests me. I like to approach these things more from, like, a historical perspective, or, like, books on directors, or, you know, biographies and stuff like that. Well, I'm interested in those kinds of things.
I find it's much easier for me to learn about someone's life after they have passed.
Yeah.
Because
you're like, I will not read about this person until they die. You're like, all right. Or in that Philip Seymour Hoffman biography. Too soon.
It hasn't even been 6 hours yet, Justin. That is the definition of too soon.
So like people like Fritz Lang, who was a known asshole, or Alfred Hitchcock, who was a known asshole.
Yeah, you know, especially stuff from like, you know, the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It's easier for me to go in and out and like, yeah, you know, read up on the work and just kind of know, because once again, also these are filmmakers and artists that I've already established my own opinion on their, mm-hmm, their works of art, and like I still have, you know, that version of that art.
So attached. It can only inform it as opposed to change it.
Yeah, it would completely change the experience. I would have that kind of new knowledge going in when I revisit, mm-hmm, that work, but I'll still always have the original, like the kind of the pure version of their, mm-hmm, their works that I can just, you know, go into without any sort of preconceived, you know, notions, you know, influencing the way, mm-hmm, that I perceive that.
Well, you know, like you were saying, I think there's good and bad, mostly bad, but there can be good there. I mentioned Robert Rodriguez, Sam Raimi's inspiring to, mm-hmm, hear about. There's like tons of low budget filmmakers, but I think that the inherent problem, because now we're getting in a whole other can of worms of reading things that want to inspire you as a filmmaker, is when people get like a chance to make like a big movie right away. That's not very inspiring because, you know, I perceive it that like that will never happen to me. So that's almost like dispiriting at the same time.
Yeah, it can always be rough in those situations, you know, kind of hear about, oh, this person was just like given, you know, $50 million to make a movie.
You know, he wrote the Boondock Saints, the Weinstein brothers, Miramax bought it up, and he shot a movie. And that guy's a giant asshole. That's a perfect example. Yeah. Troy Duffy, the filmmaker of Boondock Saints, there was a whole documentary about him called Overnight, about how he just treated everyone like absolute shit the entire time. That completely informs the piece of like sexist trash that is the Boondock Saints.
Yeah, and something else that just popped in my mind too is that I think a reason why this especially keeps happening in, you know, with directors and actors, mm-hmm, is because if you've ever been on a film set, those are some pretty high tension, yeah, you know, environments. Like, I worked before in film as an assistant director on some independent features, and you do have to be an asshole at times. Yeah. You have to be an asshole to kind of keep things moving, to, mm-hmm, keep things going. And so it is a very fine line for people to, you know, to tiptoe around of being a professional asshole, yeah, so to speak, you know, just enough to get the job done on set.
And being an asshole's asshole.
And taking it to a new level, say, along the lines of, oh God, why am I blanking on his name?
David O. Russell.
Yes, David Russell. That's exactly who I was looking for.
Yeah.
When you hear about some of his on-set antics.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, like the stuff that he's pulling like on Three Kings.
I Heart Huckabees.
Yeah. Now he seemed to have settled,
yeah,
down.
Yeah, people have kind of forgotten about that. Like, for, yeah, a while, that was David O. Russell, like, to a T, is that asshole. Well, that yelled at Lily Tomlin.
That is kind of a very perfect example. Do you think, like, the public has kind of forgotten him?
Completely. I think they've completely forgotten him. Yeah, since I Heart Huckabees, he's made Silver Linings Playbook, The Fighter.
American Hustle.
Like, that's completely been forgotten. And something interesting is that, I don't know if it was after I Heard Huckabees, but there's a whole David O. Russell film that is sitting in a can somewhere called Nailed, starring Jessica Biel, that they ran out of money and they just forgot about it. That's almost like a symbolic, like, I'm dropping, remember the memories of me and moving on to something else, which was The Fighter, which is feel-good movie. And I think the remnants of his past were there, but I don't know if he's mellowed out or has just done a better job of keeping a lid on it.
Like, it sounds like he's mellowed out a little bit.
I mean, he's worked with Christian Bale for the last...
Yeah, that's a set that you can only imagine.
Oh, that's another great example. Christian Bale.
The famous rant from Terminator Salvation. Once again, like, I think people have completely forgotten about that.
We'll never forget it, because we listen to that song like 100 times.
There is, we have to insert this now. So stay tuned after the podcast for an amazing techno remix of Christian Bale's infamous rant,
which we listened to at least 100 times on the way to New York.
Yes, we did.
So, I mean, I guess these are perfect examples that people can't transcend that work if they either make good work or just keep working.
Well, and once again, memory is short. It also depends on the, like we've mentioned, it depends on kind of the scale of their sin, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know,
yelling at someone is not something people are going to remember for very
also,
long.
Also, everyone does that. Yeah. Like, if you've never yelled at someone, like...
you're a saint? Or, like, you're killing people behind closed doors and no one knows about it.
Like, these are very natural things.
Yeah.
Like, it happens to people from time to time.
I've been yelled at by Pierce on a set, so... Yeah. And I've probably yelled at Pierce on sets.
Yeah, but... So, and that's something else, too, that I think people kind of forget is that when you hear about people yelling at each other on a film set, and when you have no experience on a film set, especially, you come from an office type environment where you're just like, oh, if someone did that, just like, oh my God, they'd be fired immediately. Yeah. They'd be tossed out on their ass. But, you know, film sets, you're dealing with people that are not usually, you're dealing with artist types where they're very sort of temperamental to begin with. You're dealing with such huge, you know, high stress environments where it's just
and
like
egos,
and also depending on the scale of the project, money, where it's just like every second is costing like thousands of dollars. And so if you like screw something up, you lose that much amount of money.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a very high stress environment where, you know, where something that could be solved in normal conversation does blow out to just like a screaming match on set, because you're working like 18 hour days. You have, you know, like maybe 2 days off. So everyone's exhausted. Everyone's grumpy. And it's easy to kind of forget. I'm not saying that it makes, you know, like David O. Russell, for example, like his antics. It doesn't excuse him in any sort of way. But it just helps to present, like, it's not pure black and white. Like, there are
on
many
film
factors.
Sets.
Yeah, on film sets.
Yeah, because on film sets and life are different. Like, celebrities do live different lives also, but, like, they should still be, like, basic, decent human beings.
Yes, yeah, so that's the thing, like, with David O. Russell, like, you heard about his antics on set, but you didn't really
Clooney punched him on the set of Three Kings.
But you didn't really hear about his antics, like, outside of set, where it's just like, oh, this guy was just, like, an asshole
all
around.
Yeah, he, like, stabbed the small boy.
So
so it's different.
Yeah. Yeah, that is something that I want to just make clear, is that the fact that, you know, kind of the scandals that you hear about people acting on set, it is a very different environment than, you know, out of set. So I think, like, the scandals that happen when people are off set also, you know, hits home a little bit more and affects their careers.
So a summary of this big question, like every big question we have, it's complicated.
It's very complicated, but that's, you know, that's kind of like, if it was just a pure, just like yes or no answer, then we would just set our at the top. Like,
yeah.
Yes. Personally, it does affect me. And like I said before, if I am seeking out someone's art, I'd rather know as little about it beforehand. And in terms of the same as reviews, I don't want to kind of read reviews before I see a film. So I like to go in, you know, just with my own baggage, you know, affecting the way that I view the experience, not the people involved. I don't want their baggage also. Yeah.
And like you said, like I said, I like to read about people and learn more things. And at the same time, even if they're negative people, that just informs what you're watching. Mm-hmm. And it may lower the enjoyment level you have of it, but it will let you interpret it in different ways at the end of the day. And this brings on to our next topic, which is interesting because with the last two times we did Laser Blast, we like to talk about one film after our big question, and we'd have random like subject lines. And this time, we're actually going to be talking about three films. We're going to do it real quick, and two of them were supposed to be our high and low for the week. But the problem was that we just didn't really have that much of a big opinion on them. And what we ended up watching were three Wong Kar-wai films. To be specific, because we'll be talking about them all in one big bunch, it was In the Mood for Love, his first film, As Tears Go By, and his big budget famous Ashes of Time.
Yes.
Two of them we saw back to back, and In the Mood for Love we each watched separately on DVD. And In the Mood for Love is the one that when I messaged Pierce after watching it, and I said, I don't know how much I'm gonna have to discuss about this, because it's, you know, it didn't make that much of an impact for me, and because the movie is so small, and I don't want it to make it sound like that when we talk about movies, we're like, we can only deal with big emotions and blockbusters.
Well, I think there are a lot of big emotions in The Mood for Love, but the problem is that it's such an intimate film that, like, it's something that where you either have to, you know,
digest it,
where you need a chance to digest it, but also to kind of, like, fully delve into these characters in this film. Like, that's an entire kind of podcast on its own. But the problem is that immediately after watching it, I'm just like, yeah, that was a good movie. Like, I
don't need to watch it again.
I see the charm, but the thing is, like, I didn't have the immediate desire to kind of dig in deeper into it and kind of like find out what makes it tick. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not in any way saying that it's a bad film or a boring film. It's a gorgeous film. It has, you know, the themes that it presents are very striking. The production of the film I found to be very interesting. It's history, but yeah, it was just one of those situations where after we both watched it, it was just kind of like, it's good, but we don't really have that much to say on it aside from that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's cool that we were talking about film and stress like that. And once you learn about how Wong Kar-wai works and how that results in the films that he makes, and that he is a filmmaker that takes forever to make his film, that he can't make up his mind.
Well,
and
some films it takes forever for him, because, like, In the Mood for Love shot for, you know, 15 months or whatever.
Yeah.
They shot
reams
a lot of the
and
film.
Reams of footage.
They shot a lot of the film in one location, then they found a new location, like, hey, this looks more like what we wanted. So they went back and they reshot those scenes. And I was viewing some of the behind-the-scenes footage, and, like, there are all these scenes where it looks like they were shooting just, like, they shot so much footage just with, like, a straightforward, like, romantic comedy.
Yeah.
But it's a very interesting film where it looks like a lot of it was shaped kind of as it went along. So it started out as this one type of project. It was conceived and pitched as, you know, kind of this, like, this foodie comedy about, like, couples that, you know, that keep meeting up over lunch, and it kind of, you know, evolve from there. But I think it's very interesting to have a film, you know, where its initial design and sort of concept and even shooting was very broad, was very all over the place. But then when you get such a, you know, a fine-tuned package that just, like, it feels like everything is just, like, perfectly predetermined, just like note for note, just like he had it all planned ahead of time.
Yeah.
It's very interesting for me to learn that just, like, no, he was kind of just, you know, making up as he went along. But the fact that he was able to create such a finely polished piece from that still speaks, you know, volumes about the filmmaker.
And I mean, as a filmmaker, Wong Kar-wai still does that, because his last film, The Grand Master, was, like, shooting and editing for, I think, 5 years? Like, they keep saying, like, oh, this year it'll play at the Cannes Film Festival. Oh, no, wait, this year it'll play. And then the other film we saw, which was his first big martial arts epic, Ashes of Time, also has a famous production history, most specifically because he shot what is arguably his most famous film, Chungking Express, during a break of making Ashes of Time.
Yeah, a 2-month break where he's just like, you want,
I'll make a movie.
No, it was also part of what he was contractually obligated to make another movie with the production company. So he took the time, just like, I need a break from this. So he just like barfed out this script, and it just turned out to be one of the most, like, amazing things that he'd done. And it was, like, a huge, huge international hit for 1994. And it's on so many people's, like, you know,
best of.
And just, like, it's a very influential and very, you know, it's just an amazing film. And the fact that it's something that he just kind of poured out of him in that short amount of time was just out kind of thinking about it, as opposed to, you know, kind of his other films where he does spend all this time kind of just, like, figuring out what he wants to do. I find that very interesting as a filmmaker, that he's able to, you know, approach cinema from those two standpoints, where it's just kind of very, you know, free flowing, just like spitting out ideas, seeing what sticks, and just kind of going with that, but still making something that's comprehensible. And then, you know, just having, like, all these grand ideas, and then focusing on the perfectionist aspect, where he's just like, I have to get this exactly the
but
way
even
I
then
envision.
Like, the movie Falling Angels, which he made after Chungking Express, was supposed to be a story in Chungking Express and then got its own movie. And then we can go back to Ashes of Time, which is a movie that shot over a long period of time. And the film, what surprised me the most is I watched Ashes of Time probably 5-7 years ago, because it is one of those, like, Hong Kong films that people are like, you should watch this. And I don't think anyone's going to argue. Even the person who introduced the film said, like, this is not one of Wong Kar-wai's best films. And I think the result of that is having too much time to do what he wants. And I loved Ashes of Time, which I really didn't think I was going to. And I think one of the reasons I loved it so much is because it is so convoluted, and it is something that you can kind of unpack. And
it's a very dense film.
If you sit there and watch it, it's really not that confusing. like, the connections that are made are very complex, where they're like, oh, my brother's sister that's dating. And the film is portrayed unchronologically and is, like, cutting in between. And I think that's the result of a film that was shot really long. And, you know, we pointed out that the last 2 minutes of Ashes of Time is a montage of scenes that look like they could be out of Ashes of Times too, and they're full sequences, obviously, yeah. That they're just little bits of it. And, you know, watching all these films of Wong Kar-wai, his themes obviously rise to the present, and one of them is like unrequited love, and you know, things that aren't, and you know, mistakes that are made, and dwelling on those mistakes,
all those things, and also kind of perpetually looking back on the past, mm-hmm. and then also, you know, kind of like a yearning for the future, mm-hmm. Like those are themes that I especially noticed in Chungking Express, where it's just, you know, character set, you know, deadlines for themselves, mm-hmm. you know, like the guy with the pineapples, he sets, you know, like a deadline for himself, like, I'm gonna, like,
by this expiration date,
yeah, by this expiration date, like, my relationship will have expired. And for the girl, the police officer, and the girl from, was it the noodle shop, or what was the shop? It's been about a year since
Chungking Express.
from the second story, yeah, like, it's the deadline in that is set with like a plane ticket,
mm-hmm.
so, and
it's like I said this walking out of the cinema, where I'm like, man, like, Wong Kar-wai got dumped one time, and, like, he just never got over it. And there's some girl somewhere sitting in a house being, like, not unaware that Wong Kar-wai is focusing all his attention on her and what happened.
But I think that's what, you know, gives his film such a universal appeal. And what people connect with. The fact that, you know, there is a very emotional, you know, resonance to them. There is something that's very personal about them. It's something that is very romantic. There's a longing in all of his films, mm-hmm. you know, it's like I said before, it's either longing for the past, it's longing for the future, it's longing for lost love. He focuses on all these themes, and it creates, you know, a very, very approachable film, even if the subject matter is not something that's on the page kind of mm-hmm. approachable. But
I was gonna say that Ashes of Time, what really made me realize that when we left, you said that, you know, Ashes of Time was pretty good, but you didn't really emotionally connect with it. And I think that as a viewer, I didn't really emotionally connect with it too, but I think that is inherent in Wong Kar-wai's work. Because even Chungking Express, the emotions aren't like, he's not trying to make you cry. Or, you know, what he's really instilling in you is like a longing and like a reflection to think about these things that are happened. And in something like Ashes of Time, it's a little bit more difficult to connect with because he's painting it on such a mythological landscape, while something like Chungking Express is easier to connect with because it is with these day-to-day people, but the same themes are there.
Well also, with like Chungking and In the Mood for Love, and even, what was it?
As
Tears Go By. Because those films, they deal with a smaller cast,
mm-hmm.
and you know, much more relatively, you know, straightforward narrative.
Yeah.
It is easier for an outsider, and especially for people that aren't as you know, as familiar with mm-hmm. Hong Kong cinema.
Yeah, and like the actors and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, for them to approach it. Personally, the problem that I had with Ashes of Time is that I'm not as big into Asian cinema as you are, so mm-hmm. it's just like I'm not as familiar with all the actors.
You're like, who are these people?
Yeah, so for you, it's yeah. easy to see someone and be like, oh, it's this person. Like, I know they've got to have some importance. And yeah. so when they pop up again later, but I'm still just trying to figure out just like, wait, who's who? Who's
yeah.
what? Who are these people?
Yeah.
So Ashes of Time, like, it has, without spoiling anything, it's kind of, you know, like,
it's difficult to spoil something in Ashes of Time.
Yeah, but you summed it up kind of best as kind of like a Hong Kong, you know,
Last Year at Marienbad.
Yeah, kind of like a Kung Fu Last Year at Marienbad's, which is a very, very apt description of it.
Mm.
But with that, because it has so many characters and you're always jumping back and forth, and it never goes out of its way to, you know, kind of be like, this is this person. Yeah, it can be very confusing for a
first
time.
Well, Last Year Marienbad is just two people.
Yeah,
so it's easier to focus on those two things.
Yeah, it's easier to just kind of like hone your attention to like these characters and pay attention to what they're doing exactly, as so you kind of know who's important.
And I like to point out that we did not watch the Ashes of Time Redux version,
no.
which is a whole new like cut, which is supposed to clarify a lot of these things. But mm-hmm. people who have seen both versions say they prefer the original version. that we got a Donnie Darko director's cut type situation.
Yeah, I was just about to bring that up.
If you explain something too much, it kind of loses that allure. Like, if the director of Last Year at Marion Bad recut it, he's like, oh, it's all about finding a dog. That's what it's about. You kind of lose something about that. Because when it is so convoluted and, you know, all over the place, that's what I personally kind of enjoyed about Ashes of Time. Because as a swordplay film, it feels like... Wong Kar-wai is kind of bored. He doesn't really want to make this kind of movie. And we were talking about the action.
Yeah, it's very evident with the step printing and the action sequences. He's much more interested in that...
mood and a feel.
Yeah, that lucid kind of dream quality to it. So even the scenes that are supposed to be kind of like the action-oriented ones, he still finds a way to present himself, you know, as something where it just... you're getting kind of the emotion and like the intent of the scene and not so much the action.
Which may not have been a, you know, Sammo Hung, a very famous actor and choreographer who did these scenes. And you can see as the scenes are happening that there's some crazy shit going on in them where people are flipping and knocking over things, but you can't really see it that well.
Yeah. And we watched the international cut, which actually has more action scenes,
but they're still step printed to within an inch of their life.
It's still kind of this insane kind of blur of.
So if I would present this to someone, I would be like, you know, don't expect an action film. And I think that if you go in doing that, and I think that when it was originally released, they did sell it as an action film because it cost so much money and, you know, we need to get it to an audience, that you can understand why there was a lot of disappointment.
Well, I'm sure the film was also kind of infamous by the time of its release based on its production schedule.
I mean, I wasn't around back then.
As you mentioned, they were able to shoot, what, an entire parody film?
Yeah, The Eagle Shooting Heroes with the same cast, which is so ridiculous. And that's not something that, because Hong Kong as such, like at that time, it doesn't have anymore because China came in and is kind of running things now, is that Hong Kong had like a factory line kind of cinema where like all the stars in Hong Kong were pop stars. So it would be like as if Ashes of Time, like they do an adaptation of, I don't know, like a famous book like Great Expectations, and then they make like the disaster movie version of Great Expectations with that exact same cast. Like, it's so crazy to imagine that. And Eagle Shooting Heroes is actually genuinely hilarious. So if people see Ashes of Time, I would recommend it as a double bill without any contest, because it's genuinely funny and it's not as convoluted as Ashes of Time.
But out of the three Wong Kar-wai films that we viewed this week, his first film, As Tears Go By, to his 1994's Ashes of Time, to In the Mood for Love, which I think was like 99-2000.
Yeah.
Which one of those do you think is the best representation of Wong Kar-wai as a filmmaker?
I would probably have to say In the Mood for Love, as far as what people think of Wong Kar-wai as a filmmaker, as like the international appeal of him. Because the thing that we're dealing with is As Tears Go By has a lot of themes that Wong Kar-wai deals with, but I would almost call it like... it's not what his films became. What happened with Wong Kar-wai was that he worked for a long time as a screenwriter and like writing shit like Haunted Cop Shop 2. And like that's what he did. So he was used to churning out these formulaic like genre pictures for like companies. So when it came to making his directorial debut, As Tears Go By, he uses a lot of like, you know, what will become his like motifs in his further films. But he's still putting them through like a genre filter, like a very linear story with specific beats. And I remember the first time I watched it, I actually really enjoyed that it does hit those interesting beats and you do have those characters. And I like to point out that the version that we watched on 35mm was only about 2/3 subtitled. So it was a little difficult for Pierce to connect.
It was about 2/3 subtitled, and also the reels, like they kept, you know, sometimes with different film reels, you have to readjust the
subtitles would fall down.
Yeah, the subtitles were basically on the part of the screen that was cropped off. So you would just like see the top of the words and try to have to like figure out what they're saying. And it was also kind of broken English subtitles to begin with.
Yeah.
So it maybe was
it was
not
difficult
the,
to make a.
It was maybe not the best way to approach the film for a first time.
But so like As Tears Go By is, I don't know if it'd be an entry level, like, you know, you show this as a Wong Kar-wai film, and it has definitely more conventionally entertaining like pieces to it. Like, there's action scenes as Tears Go By, and there's like big dramatic moments, and there's a romance that is actually, you know, there's some contact there, which is doesn't really happen with the other Wong Kar-wai films. Yeah. While In the Mood for Love is more that like calm, you know, made up of like a bunch of pieces kind of filmmaking that people would associate from Wong Kar-wai, from Chungking Express to In the Mood for Love, for Fallen Angels to 2046, which is like the unofficial sequel to In the Mood for Love. So I think that In the Mood for Love is more of an atypical example of Wong Kar-wai's works and themes.
I would have to agree. Out of the films that we saw, I like, as much as I like In the Mood for Love, I do think Ashes of Time is a film that I want to kind of revisit in the future and kind of go over. The thing with me personally In the Mood for Love is that it felt like such a kind of a perfect piece to begin with, is that after viewing it, I'm just like, yeah, that movie was absolutely fantastic. It has all these themes. It has all these... And the acting is also just absolutely spectacular.
Tony Leung and Maggie Cheung are...
Yeah, their performances are just amazing. But I think it's at a certain point when films are kind of too perfect...
Starship Troopers?
Hey, Starship Troopers is pretty perfect.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, you know, they're just so polished and they're so fine... They almost become less interesting because it's sometimes the blemishes that are, you know, found in those that make them, you know, a lot more interesting. It's kind of like the argument about practical effects versus CG effects. CG is something that's perfect, so and it's therefore, you know, inherently less interesting because of the fact that it doesn't have those flaws. It's the flaws that make something interesting. So I think I found with In the Mood for Love that because it was just such a damn tight and perfect film, probably because of all the time that he spent on it, that it's missing a lot of those flaws that I do...
Oh, that's interesting.
That I do find to be a lot... Which is probably why I think Chungking Express is still my favorite film of his.
Because it's
I
so saw. Rough around the edges.
Because it's so rough that, around like, the edges.
Like, this is what I have.
You know, it's just like a pure expression of just, you know, like ideas and mood and just and feelings. It's just, it puts itself out there. It has, you know, bits to it that... It does have scenes that feel perfectly constructed, but on a whole, it does feel like it's played a little bit looser. It does feel like, you know, it feels a lot more organic. It feels like it's something that a person made, as opposed to In the Mood for Love. It feels like something that just, like, they created this awesome machine that can just make, you know, a fantastic movie. And they just, like, put in the pieces. Like, these are the themes I want to explore. They typed it in and just, like, it printed it out. So, like I said, I think In the Mood for Love is maybe too perfect for me, which is the reason why I had a hard time, you know, just like latching onto it the same way that I did with Chungking Express or even Ashes of Time.
So Pierce, not too much In the Mood for Love. we'll have to revisit some Wong Kar-wai films for another podcast. Like we said before on the previous podcast, if you have an opinion on Wong Kar-wai or even have an opinion on the big question that we asked, feel free to post on the Laser Blast Film Society Facebook page. Christopher Brown, a loyal listener, brought up a good conversation about our Mulholland Drive topic from last week. And now we move on to our High and Low, where we try to watch classic film and one not-so-classic film. Last week we did John Ford, and this week we ended up seeing a Godard film, Vivre sa vie.
Yes.
And I decided, on my own free will, because Vivre sa vie is about prostitutes, to watch Pretty Woman, probably the most famous, I would say, public consciousness film about prostitutes.
I think it's, in the pop culture light, it's the most kind of, you know, just like approachable prostitutes have been to the pop culture.
Even though I would say that when I really start discussing it, because I like to point out that I said this movie, I said, Pierce, we should watch Pretty Woman. And he went, no. And then I went, as the days went on, I went, Pretty Woman, Pretty Woman. I'm like, dude, Pretty Woman is on Netflix. And he's like, fine, I'll watch Pretty Woman on Netflix. Then I asked him the next day, I'm like, did you watch Pretty Woman yet? And he's like, no. And
hey, I watched my internet was down for a day. That was my Pretty Woman.
I watched it and I went, I gave him my opinion of it. And then I'm like, but you have to watch it too. And then when I showed up today, I'm like, did you watch Pretty Woman? And he went, no. So it may be a little bit of one-sided conversation, but I think this could also lead into a conversation about classics and comedies and stuff like that. But Vivre sa vie by Jean Luc Godard. What's happening right now is that the Lightbox, the TIFF Lightbox, is putting on a Godard retrospective. They're doing all of his early films. And
right now it's part one, where it's his earlier films.
When they show part two, I don't think anyone's going to show up because, will they do part two?
For part, I'm assuming they're going to do, because part one, like, almost all the screens have been.
They should have just called it Jean Luc Godard, the movies you probably want to see. like I would, if I was programming, I would have mixed it up so you can trick people.
Yeah, where you just like you show something like you know, the bigger, more appeal, where you have something like Breathless, then you follow up with like one of his later films from
the ones no one cares about.
Yeah, like the 80s, like the 80s and the 90s.
Yeah,
films,
like King Lear, the movie where Woody Allen is in.
Oh, it all connects
together. So Vivre sa vie, I had never seen it before. I am someone who, with a lot of the French New Wave, I'm really interested in them as filmmakers, but every time I try to watch their film, suddenly something draws my attention somewhere else. So I think that watching it in the cinema was probably the perfect opportunity to watch it. And I think that I actually really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to going in.
Something that I've been curious about, since you do speak French, you're bilingual. Yep. So when you're watching these films, are you reading the subtitles, or are you just watching the film?
It's a little bit of half and half, because they are speaking, you know, a dialect of French that is not mine. It's French from France, so it is spoken differently, and they use a lot of expressions that I don't quite understand. If you've ever turned down the sound on a movie and put the subtitles on, that suddenly you can understand what everyone is saying very clearly. But if you turn those subtitles off, you're like, I have no idea what anyone's saying. Yeah. Like, and that's another reason I did try to watch Godard films with no subtitles, and my attention would waver, because I wouldn't say that I don't understand what's going on, but there's like a word or here or two or there that's a little bit difficult to make out.
Well, and going back to, like, English is English, but, like, you try to watch, like, Snatch or something, you're not paying attention.
Yeah, you're like, wait, what's going on?
Yeah, it's easy for you to kind of to fall out. But, yes, going back to Viva Savi.
I was going to say that I've been reading the book Everything is Cinema, which is a biography of Godard that's pretty famous, and which you can find in any used bookstore, because they seem to have enough copies to choke, you know, a goat. Viva Savi is a film that Godard tried to take a step back from everything that he was associated with, as far as the New Wave, which is like handheld and we're doing all these dolly shots. And he tried to make a movie where he would use different kinds of cameras, so everything is locked down or on dolly tracks. And instead of being cut up like something like Breathless, he would have the scenes just play out in long takes.
Yes, like the opening scene of the film, you're focused on our main character, played by Anna Karenina.
That's actually the reason for that. It's a famous quote that François Truffaut said, where he's like, some filmmakers film people from the front, other people are back filmmakers, that they can film a character from the back. I don't know the exact quote, but he put Jean-Luc Godard in the, he can only film people from the front. So Jean-Luc Godard, his reaction to that was, I'm going to shoot a whole opening scene just on Anna Karenina's back.
Yeah. We'll just call her Anna, since none of us are comfortable pronouncing her last name, which is the same, because she's a fantastic actress.
Yeah,
she's fantastic, and she's so good in this film. Like, it's, the film revolves around her as she
is completely.
But that opening scene, it, you know, as compared to the other works of Godard that I am familiar with, I'm much more familiar with him in terms of that pop filmmaker, where it's just like, you know, it's
Pierre Le Fou and like Breathless,
where, you know, the films have a certain energy to them. There's a certain you know, mischievous quality to it. You know, it's got that lightheartedness. But, you know, the opening scene of this movie, where we spend, was it like five minutes
on her back?
Yeah, on the back of these characters talking, and it's just. But even with the conversation that they're having, it feels like the right choice, because it is such a distant conversation, you know, basically like a couple ending their relationship, and it creates a certain voyeuristic quality, where you feel like you're in that cafe, you're sitting at the table, and you're overhearing, you're watching this entire scene take place. And I think that really sets up kind of the mood for the rest of the film, where you're just kind of this external viewer on all the situations, and this character's unfortunate sort of chain of events that, you know, leads her down this path.
Something that wasn't subtitled at the beginning, which I find really informed as I was watching it and I started making these connections, is that the title card at the beginning says "Dedicated to B-Movies," which I don't believe was in the subtitles.
No, I didn't. I didn't see it in the
subtitles. And when you put it through that filter and the way that he's shooting it, a lot of what I was watching reminded me of stuff like Gun Crazy, which is like long takes, and because the cameras are so big, you couldn't do so much with them. And it is filmed in that kind of sense. And, you know, I would say that Vivre sa vie is still in that period of Godard's filmmaking where he's still kind of telling a story, while something like Weekend or La Chinoise is like not a story. It's just like throwing stuff going on.
I'm excited to see Weekend. That's
and and while the film is broken up into 12 chapters, so it's like very particular scenes, you do get like a mood, and you do get set pieces that inform the character, and that you can connect an emotional attachment to this person that goes beyond just like philosophical rumblings, which is, from a lot of Godard films I have, you know, that's what it is. Yeah. So it is an interesting film that, while it does have like that slow kind of like glacial pace at some scenes, and characters do have a habit of just talking to each other and sharing philosophical ideas, there are characters there that you can attach importance to, which I think, you know, separates it from a lot of his films.
Yeah, and I did really enjoy the chapter quality to it, because there's something about it where you see, you know, these, you know, kind of the story of this character unfold, it's interesting to know just like, oh, there's only two chapters left.
Like, yeah, it's counting it down.
Yeah, it takes that, you know, that ticking clock, you know, mm-hmm. that you would typically have in like a script, you know, like an action movie where you have that ticking clock mechanic mm-hmm. where it's just like you got to keep driving the action forward. Here it's presented, you know, and just like, here's a chapter where it's just like, and it has those handy title cards at the beginning mm-hmm. where it basically tells you, so some time can pass in between the scenes. Yeah. And those title cards, by breaking up the chapters, like, you don't feel like you've lost anything. Like, mm-hmm. there may be things that you're a little bit fuzzy about, but it definitely fills that in as it's going mm-hmm. on. So I just found that to be a, you know, a very unique way of telling that certain story, which, and the B-movie thing is something that I was thinking about.
Yeah.
But it does certainly have that kind of, like, pulpy, you know, mm-hmm. cautionary tale.
Yeah.
That vibe to it.
Which, originally, it didn't. Originally, the film... We're getting into a little bit of spoilers territory, mm-hmm. but it's kind of tough to spoil, like, a Godard film, like, whether the final beat of the film.
Yeah, because so much happens
yeah. to it. But, originally, the film was going to end with her, the main character of Anna, marrying one of the, you know, Johns she finds, because she mm-hmm. does become a prostitute. That's the main plot of the film, which happens kind of fast. Like, suddenly yeah. she's a prostitute. She marries a John, she lives happily ever after. And Godard at the last minute decided, no, I don't want to do that. So he took it in a much more like negative light, and like the movie ends in a way where like, huh, like the audience is kind of like shocked at what happened, because you do get that connection with the main character because you followed her throughout so long yeah. throughout the film. And at the same time, tying back into our big question, the film, reading the book Everything is Cinema, is a comment on Godard's relationship with Anna. Where there's a passage in the movie where a character is reading a poem from Poe, Edgar Allan Poe. Mm-hmm. If it is or not, I'm not an Edgar Allan Poe expert. But he's talking about a girl, and he's basically describing Anna at that time, the actress, and what she's going through in the film. And that voice is not the actor's voice. That's Godard's voice that's reading that dialogue. So it does have, like, it's impossible to watch this film once you know more information about what was going on in the relationship between Godard and Anna, you know, without filtering it through that.
Well, it's a very interesting relationship because it's spread across so many different films.
Yeah.
Like, I also viewed Band of Parts this mm-hmm. week as well, and that is something that I've actually have read up a little bit, is, you know, the relationship yeah. between those two. It does have an influence, but I do think it makes that a little bit more interesting mm-hmm. knowing, you know, their connection. But yeah, and it is funny that you mentioned kind of the original ending.
Yeah.
Which I'm going to lead way into, is that what Pretty Woman basically was? Did it take that concept where, you know, it has a happy ending with the John that she finds?
Yes. Well, let me say that Pretty Woman for me it's always been a joke. Like, it's yeah. always been a joke. Like, when people talk about Pretty Woman, like, do you know anyone that's like, Pretty Woman, great film? I don't think I've ever heard anyone let that.
I've never heard that from anyone either. This could be the fact that we just don't have that many
friends who yeah, are
friends
like...
Friends that love Pretty Women.
But the movie, not Pretty Girls.
Yeah, but maybe that's the reason that we're friends with them. So yeah. who knows? But yeah, so I admit,
you have not seen it, so you're the interviewee here.
I chickened out. I was the bastard on this. I was just
the film,
like,
is 2 hours long.
That's really long for a movie starring Julia Roberts as a hooker.
And Julia Roberts, that's not the big problem. Is I think what originally made me the most interested, and I messaged Pierce about this, is the movie has no jokes. It's barely a comedy, and I think this may be the result, if you read up on Pretty Woman, that it was a drama at first. It was called, I think, 3,000. Yeah, it was 3,000, because mm-hmm. that's how much Julia Roberts charges Richard Gere to spend a week with him. And the problem with the film is, and this is a problem that I have with a lot of, which is basically a Pygmalion story. For example, My Fair Lady, mm-hmm. where it's like the guy makes a girl into something else. It is basically a sexist story. And Pretty Woman never escapes that bond. I mean, the first time that you see Julia Roberts, she's goddamn sexualized. It like starts on a pan of her butt, and she's wearing like lingerie, and it just pans up to her face, and she like turns the clock off. And this would be okay if her character, like, you know, changed Richard Gere in some way, or like learned a lesson about herself, but she doesn't. She is a pawn throughout the film.
Well, here's an interesting a note to kind of bring up. Would that bother you so much if these were presented as, you know, kind of shady characters? Is the fact that it's presented in a context where this is, you know, like a, you know, an A title, you know, pop culture, like this is released, where it's presenting these characters as kind of normal. It's not presenting it in any sort of, you know, like you would in kind of like these B movies or kind of like pulpier stuff where like you do have like these characters, you know, like the very sexualized, you know, kind of like prostitutes with hearts of gold or like the, you know, the kind of the sexist guys. Does that bother you in general if that happens in a movie, or does it only bother you if it's presented in a way where it's saying like, this is normal, this is the way that it's perfectly okay?
Yeah, you just summed it up. I hate to be on the moral high horse, but it is presenting like, this is okay. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think it also comes down to like Julia Roberts as a character is not active. Like, she never makes any decisions for herself. All the decisions are through the prism of Richard Gere, who's acting like Patrick Bateman in American Psycho. Like, there's nothing charming about him. At one point, he takes her to the opera and he's like, you know, opera, you either love it or hate it. I mean, if you're there at first, it'll, you know, and you love it, you'll start crying and it'll affect you. But if you don't like it at first, maybe you can learn to appreciate it. But, you know, you'll never really love it. And then opera starts and he, like, stares at Julia Roberts. So basically what he's saying is, like, if you don't love opera, you're a fucking jackass. Like, this is a character we're supposed to like and feel better for? Like, the big lesson of the film is that at the end he decides, you know what, I won't buy out this company. I'll help them out instead. Which makes no sense and is never earned. So it's just, like, morally... It's not only morally repugnant and it's saying that this is okay, it's not funny. It's not even trying. Like, the only amusing parts is that there's three montage. That's it.
Would you like kind of allow the characters, you know, kind of to be the way they are? If it was at least charming or funny, would you still...
I would probably not like it that much, but it feels like it's not even trying. And I think that's the most insulting part of it all. Like, that cover of, like, Julia Roberts back-to-back with Richard Gere, that's about as funny as a movie gets, that cover right there. Like, there's no jokes. And
oh, but posters, like, they are so notorious. Yeah. Like, you take anything, you put two smiling people on, it's automatically a romantic comedy. Doesn't matter what it is.
Which is funny because Vivre sa vie is about a hooker who doesn't have any problems being a hooker. Mm-hmm. Because Anna in the film is never presented as, like, I hate being a hooker. That never happens in the movie. Which, you know, has its own moral quandaries in itself. But Pretty Woman, it's just presented in a different way that, like, I mean, no one's going to argue that Gary Marshall is a good director. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen him on the TV show On the Lot, where he would, like, rate, like, short films, but he just made himself look like a senile old man on that movie. And he's still making movies. He did Valentine's Day and New Year's Eve.
But those are supposed to be, like laugh-out-loud train wrecks.
Yeah, and sadly, Pretty Woman, it doesn't have enough for me to even call it a laugh-out-loud train wreck. And that's, you know, the biggest issue, other than the fact that, like, Julia Roberts is a hooker who has no sexual diseases, she doesn't do drugs, she's really pretty, she has no emotional problems, you know, she's just fine. And, you know, she helps Richard Gere. She's not even really a hooker with a heart of gold, she's just, like, you know, an okay person. Like, she doesn't do any, like, crazy actions. At one point, Richard Gere thought that he's a good person by telling her, I never treated you like a prostitute, even though he did pay her for his time. Like,
do you think this is more of, like, audiences, you know, responded favorably to the film because of the time that was released in? Do you think that much has changed in terms of, you know, the public's conscious, especially in terms of I don't know why this is escaping me, but, you know, in terms of, you know, feminist kind of approach to filmmaking, do you think that's changed?
It was made in like the late 80s or the early 90s. I don't think.
Yeah, like, but that's been like, you know, like 20 years. Yeah,
but the thing is, like, dumb movies exist even today. Like,
they do.
Like, it's not. It's just what's baffling about this movie is, like, looking at it and being like, it's like the same experience I had with Gone with the Wind, where I enjoyed Gone with the Wind because it was so gonzo fucking crazy. But watching it, I was like, how can people, like, genuinely enjoy this? Like, these people are awful characters. And how did it touch that, like, public consciousness nerve?
Well, some films is interesting to see the legacy that they have. Mm-hmm. Like, Casablanca is, you know, regarded as, like, this amazing, you know, like, greatest screen romance. When so very little of the film is about romance, it's you know, this war espionage, you know, like crime film, when it's about a character kind of learning to let go of love instead of. So it's very baffling to kind of see the way that, you know, audiences, they think of films or the way that they presented the films. And I think a lot of it just comes down to, like I said before, it's much easier to slap, you know, a photo of two people smiling at each other and just, like, looking at love, and it's easier to sell something as a romantic comedy as it is in terms of, you know, like a drama that has a little bit of romance. Or
it'd be interesting if Pretty Woman was just like a film that like people finally remembered. It's in goddamn 1001 Movies to See Before You Die. Shame on you, 1001 Movies, for including Pretty Woman in there, unless it's just a cultural art, you know, artifact, and that's why it's there.
But it was such a hit. Huge. It was a huge film.
Like, I didn't know that montage sequence in Dumb and Dumber, it's scored to Pretty Woman. It's just a reference to Pretty Woman. I just thought they were using the song ironically, but it's a direct reference. It's funnier in Dumb and Dumber. There's more laughs in that one, like, 2-minute scene of Dumb and Dumber than there is in all of Pretty Woman, which it almost feels like they just shot a drama, and they're like, oh, we'll sell it as a comedy. I mean, Jason Alexander's in the movie as, like, the foil of Richard Gere's character. Yeah. So, it's, you know, I'm just baffled. And I'd like someone to, like, you know, post on the Laser Blast forum or just be like, this is, I was alive at around this time and this is why the movie was popular. Yeah, you know, it hit this cultural, you know.
I'm curious to know, was it something where it was, you know, kind of something much more akin to, say Twilight, mm-hmm. where it was something where it still was a huge, you know, cultural phenomenon. It still was a huge box office success. But the time it was released, people still were going, you know, like, you know, this is horseshit.
Yeah.
I want to know if that was the case or if this was something that the critics kind of universally were just like, yeah, Pretty Woman, it's a solid movie.
But the movie hits like a universe, like it's telling a well-worn story. Like mm-hmm. it's not like, you know, the like handsome, you know, knight comes and saves a woman and takes her off on horseback. Like that's a story that's always existed and people have mm-hmm. always been interested in that. That's basically the plot of Twilight.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can understand why it hit that cultural nerve, but like looking back on it, like it's not good. I can't find anything really redeemable about it, unless you're someone that wants to be completely unchallenged by a film, not laugh, not really feel anything dramatic other than the people at the end have a happy ending.
So you're proving that I made the right choice by sitting out.
No, you have to watch it this week and we'll talk about it next week, and then you'll have to play the E.T. video game, and that's will be the two things that you'll have to do.
I did not agree to this. I did not agree to these terms.
So like we usually do before we go out, we like to share some recommendations of movies that we saw this week. And Pierce pointed out that he's in kind of a weird position right now, because while he's trying to tackle all these Hollywood films, he's not really going to find like a classic, like an indie Hollywood classic that no one talks
about. I'm not going to find a hidden gem for the next little while, because as I did say, I'm basically giving myself, you know, an updated film school history in terms of all these classic films. And the problem is, you know, watching all these films that are considered classics or like very important or significant, is that I kind of feel like an asshole, you know, recommending, you know, films that are considered some of the greatest films of all time.
But, so I'm going to jump in and be the cool guy and recommend a film that hopefully you haven't heard of, which is a film I just saw today, and it played at the Toronto International Film Festival. It's a movie called Rhymes for Young Ghouls, which is a first-time filmmaker, which is a story set in the 70s about a young girl dealing with living on a native reservation in Canada. And the film is definitely a first-time filmmaker's film, because it's, you know, it's scruffy and rough around the edges, and it just, the filmmaker throws everything that he wants in it. It's like a daughter-father drama, there's a heist a subplot, there's like, you know, a drug movie, so there's a little bit of like Scorsese, like Guy Ritchie-ness to it. There's zombies in like dream sequences.
I remember, you know, this film getting a lot of buzz at a TIFF last year when it made its premiere, I think. It has something that's been on my radar, but I am curious, like, how do all those elements tie into each other? Something that's kind of a coherent package.
They do. I think the film is fairly coherent, and it does have like an emotional like through line that's very easy to follow. The movie that I compared it to while I was watching it, which is a much more low-key film, is Winter's Bone, the Jennifer Lawrence film, where it touches the kind of same subject matter. And especially Rhymes for Young Ghouls, it's so interesting because it is like a world that we don't often see. And I mean, I've heard about it because a friend of mine, which I haven't talked to in a long time, Nicholas Rogers, who Pierce also knows, did live in that world. And I believe he's kind of in that world right now. It's not set in the 70s, of course, but it's kind of, you know, we're not going to get into this can of worms, but like, Canada as a place has not treated its native population very well.
I don't think North America really North has America in general.
In general. And this film is not only like a time capsule from the 70s, but it's also commenting on, you know, the ongoing debate of these kind of things while still telling a compelling story with, you know, it's fun to see all these actors that, like, you've probably never seen before, especially the lead performance by the young girl. So it's definitely something that even if you watch, and I'm sure some people will be like, I didn't really like that, you can still appreciate for the things that it does. It's playing right now at the Young and Dundas Theater, formerly the AMC Cineplex. Yes. Mm-hmm. So go check it out, because it's probably only going to be there for a week, like most of these films, because it had no advertising. I didn't really know it was coming out until I checked on Friday. And
yeah, you got to be. I always found, especially with that particular cinema in general and downtown Toronto, the, like you said, the Cineplex. Mm-hmm. I believe it's the Young and Dundas 24 screens, but it's best to just kind of.
Look.
Just, you know, check once a week and look and see what they're playing. Because they have some crazy shit showing there.
And they, not only the retros, which you can find a list that Pierce posted on the Laser Blast Film Society Facebook page. They also do, like, Hong Kong films, Korean films, Hindi films. Like, they play all of these, but, like, we never really hear about it. And I don't think the newspapers usually review them. Like, it's not something they tackle because it's not, you know, nationwide.
Oh, well, it's because Cineplex here is in an interesting state because the fact that with their Scotiabank cinema and, like, all these little cinemas that they have around town, when they bought out that AMC theater...
It has, like, 24 screens.
Yeah, they had 24 extra screens that they had to program with, so... You know, while that does do some damage to kind of the smaller indie cinemas in town, it still presents an opportunity to get, you know, kind of these crazy films that you wouldn't get shown anywhere. And
but even, like, these are mainstream films in South Korea. Like, no art house cinema in Toronto would have played them anyway. But
exactly.
You had the opportunity to go and see them at a local cinema. And that's, you know, like, a really great opportunity. But you just have to go and search it out for yourself because no one's going to tell you that these
films
are playing.
They're not going to be advertising. No. Like, you're not going to see a, you know, a TTC banner for one of these.
No. And on the same point, I want to recommend a website that me and Pierce started visiting recently, thedissolve.com, which is a movie completely dedicated to movies, which I had heard about because I read the AV Club was quite a lot of regularity, and The Dissolve kind of cherry-picked from all of these, like, different websites and got all these great writers to write essays and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, it's not just, you know, the best of, like, articles from the web. Like, as you said, they do have some fantastic articles.
Original. Yeah.
It seems that, like, once a month they choose, like, kind of a film and they...
Every week.
Oh,
yeah,
every
and they week. Discuss and write multiple articles about that film.
And, like, I read up on... I read up on a couple of them. I didn't read King Comedy because I haven't seen King Comedy yet. It's on my list. But I did read their one on Fargo. They had some excellent, you know, kind of essays and expositions on Fargo.
As Pierce said when I sent him the website, he says, I hate this website because they have so many good articles. I'm jealous of them. So really what we're saying is we need to start creating content for the Laser Blast Film Society blog.
Yeah, as you said before, tying back into our previous conversation, it's one of those things you look at and just like, ah, it's so good. It's encouraging, but it's also very discouraging.
Yeah, because you're like, we're never going to do this. We need little, like, drawn photos of our faces that we can put on our bylines. So what classic Hollywood film will you make a recommendation of this week, Pierce?
Well, it is tough this week because I did see a lot of a great cinema that I would recommend regardless. I saw Eraserhead for the first time this week. Fantastic film brought on by our discussion of Lynch last week.
Saw
Band of Parts, but I think out of all the films that I kind of saw this week, it was a toss-up between two. It was a toss-up between John Ford's Stagecoach, which is absolutely lovely film. It's a great, fantastic cast of characters, amazing performances. You can see the reason why John Wayne became a star based upon his portrayal in the film. And the Billy Wilder film, which is a film that I put off for such a long time without really knowing why, but The Apartment.
Yeah.
And this is what I was thinking of during your kind of review of Pretty Woman, is the fact that The Apartment, I think, for the reason that I put off for so long, is because the goddamn poster for this film. It's just Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine, like, smiling. And then, like, occasionally you get, like, some additional poster art where it throws Fred McMurray in there smiling as well. So it just made me think that, it's just going to be, you know, Jack Lemmon's going to do his spiel. And, like, Shirley MacLaine's going to be this crazy pixie woman. And Fred McMurray's going to come in and be
smile.
Like, yeah, you know, like, do his shaggy dog shit. And but what I was so, somehow I, calm
shaggy
down, Justin.
Shaggy dog shit. All right.
Calm down, Justin. But you know, when I put it on this morning and, you know, hit play, it just like this stunning, you know, like anamorphic widescreen, just mm-hmm. like stark black and white mm-hmm. presentation of just this incredibly dark and adult story that mm-hmm. I was not expecting. The apartment, as you know, it is about this guy that loans out his apartment for people to have affairs in.
Yeah.
And it's just the fact that, you know, this film came at the time when it did, and mm-hmm. and Jack Lemmon and everyone, they just give such powerful powerhouse performances throughout the entire thing that has just such a, you know, a strong sense of, you know, this bittersweet emotion, mm-hmm. pure comedy, some really dark but also very like human issues. It's something that did not feel, because a film that, you know, in our Lost Laser Blast episode.
Yeah, the Lost pilot of the new and improved Laser Blast. Where we talked about Some Like It Hot.
Yeah, Some Like It Hot. And Some Like It Hot was the film Billy Wilder did before this, which is basically, he was just like, I, you know, freaking love Jack Lemmon. This guy's amazing. And his performance in that basically inspired Billy Wilder to kind of, you know, do something different, to do something that could, you know, encompass all this drama, all this comedy, all these kind of dark yet sweet kind of human emotions, and has something that was very, very real about it. And so the film that he made immediately after that, which, you know, is this very lighthearted, not very deep, kind of shallow on the surface, you know, a comedy, Some Like It Hot, was followed by The Apartment. And like, the two couldn't be more different. They couldn't be like further apart. But The Apartment, it is just, It's one of those films that I watch and go, you know, the Academy Awards got it right this mm-hmm. year, because that year it won for Best Director, it won for Best Picture, and Best Screenplay. And I think it won some others as well. But yeah, it is just an absolutely beautiful and fantastic film, which it's probably the best film that I saw this week, so it gets my recommendation.
All right, so Rhymes for Young Ghouls and The Apartment are the Laser Blast Film Society recommendations of the week. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next week. What don't you fucking understand? Suck him, kick your fucking ass.